Welcome to Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. I have with me today Arthur Phillips, the novelist. He's the author of four books at this point. The newest one is called The Song Is You. Welcome, Arthur.
Thanks.
You hear a little background noise. We're in New York. Arthur is from New York City. Well, actually, lives in New York City, is from Minneapolis. I guess I wanted, you know, this is your fourth book. It's gotten, it's gotten great reviews. I read all the reviews on the website. I thought, you know, some of them were off base. I think the way people summarized the book was kind of odd in some ways. So I wanted to ask you kind of, for you, what is the book about?
Yeah. Well, the book is about music and a love affair with music. It's about... maybe I should start again. A synopsis of the plot is, I guess, different than a synopsis of what it feels like it's about for me. A synopsis of the plot is a middle-aged man falls in love with the voice and sight of a woman half his age who he never really meets because she's so connected to him musically. A synopsis of what it seems like to be about for me is about the love of music, and specifically the love of music that you have pumped into your headphones all the time if you're someone who walks around with music all the time as I am. It's about music's effect on your emotions and your memories and even finally your actions. It's about getting reaching a certain midlife milestone and thinking about whether you've done everything that you want to do and whether you've done it right or not and whether you still feel or can regain that sense of passion and possibility of being 20 years younger.
Yeah, and I read the one thing on your website that really caught my attention was the there was a little introduction about how it was almost like how you thought of the book, which is a question that people always ask writers. You know, how'd you come up with this idea? How autobiographical it is? And I thought reading that was very important to me because you described essentially the constant imaginative play in your own mind about alternative futures, alternative pasts almost. Would that be fair to say? And that that's how this book germinated?
Well, there certainly is part of that. I mean, the thing about listening to music, as I have listened to music, and I'm sure a lot of people do, is you go back to your favorite songs and suddenly you realize, wow, that's been my favorite song or on my list of favorite songs for 20 years now or 25 years now. And I remember when I used to listen to it, what it would feel like. And I remember, so that you can even cast yourself back into that state of mind, feeling 19 years old listening to that song. And one of the things that I remembered about listening to a particular song when I was 19 was imagining myself listening to that song later in life,
right?
And where I would be and what I would be doing and what might have happened to me. And so, this book is not really at all autobiographical, but it is somewhat the biography of somebody I could have been, something that might have happened to me if things had gone a little...
No, but that's what kind of caught my attention is that, I think it's important to say that the imagination of one's own life does not have to be literal, and that you can imagine yourself as another person in a way that's what a novel can be.
Kundera, a big hero of mine, Milan Kundera, talked about writing imaginary selves or fictional selves or potential selves as characters.
Right.
It doesn't take long before what you're creating is far, far, far away from who you are.
But also the other thing that I thought was interesting, and of course I'm not trying to psychoanalyze you in this, but when I was in college, one of my favorite writing teacher taught me to read novels as solutions to problems that the author may not necessarily even be aware of. And I kind of wanted to ask you in that sense, you know, was this for you, or consciously, are you aware of it solving a kind of any problem? And I don't mean that as a psychological problem, where it's kind of like it could even be a logical problem. You know, in a way, it may not be a fair question because, you know, you may not even think of it that way.
Solving a problem. Well, certainly the act of writing a book, I mean, let's go back a second. People do often ask, where did the idea for this come from? How did this all start? And what? And in my case, the answer to that is often, it started with something very small. I used to think, before I wrote books, that people who wrote books thought of books and then wrote them down. as opposed to what, as far as I can tell, really happens, which is you think of something small and you start writing about that small thing, and then you think of another small thing, and then you start gluing small things together, and then you have a chapter, and so on and so forth, and then you have to sort of sort through your garden. And
so an organic growth.
It's an organic thing that you prune, and then you go back to the beginning and say, why did I start this in the first place? Oh, I wanted to grow roses. Well, I still have a bed of roses, but now it's surrounded by something
right.
very different than I didn't realize was coming. And so that process entails certain problems. It produces technical problems and structural problems and compositional problems, and you can smell there's a hole over here. Something is not coming to life the way it's supposed to if we're going to finish this garden. And so there's a million of those things as you go through the process. Is there a larger overarching problem that I guess I was wrestling with? Probably not. Although in retrospect, it does seem to be one possible answer to the question, what's supposed to happen to you in the middle of your life?
No, that's fair.
Yeah.
I think several things attracted me to the novel. You know, I try to only... Yeah, you know, only so much time in the day, so I try to only read books that I like. For me, because I've listened to a lot of music, I maybe not as obsessive as you are, but I've listened to music, you know, in the same way from the minute I was conscious.
Yeah.
And I also remember stuff that my father was playing, you know, and on the, you know, then the mono hi-fi. But and your description of the internal, I think the internal process of how you respond to music, that's a hard thing to write about, I think. I thought you evoked that really well.
Thank you.
I also thought that you were very lyrical, I think somebody else used that word, but I thought in deft, in describing the emotion that the two main, main characters are, the main character and his estranged wife, their relationship, I thought you had incredibly complicated descriptions that were really evocative, really worked well.
Thank you.
And then, of course, the main character being Kate. There, I thought was really interesting because, you know, anybody who listens in our culture, we all listen to rock and roll. We all have to deal with this whole issue of our attraction to the musician and the complexity of what that means. It could just be, you know, we love them.
Right.
We love what they do to us. But people act crazy
yeah.
when they become attracted to a particular musician. And your guy, your character, on one level, you could read him as completely over the top, out of his mind. To me, what happened was he used the whole relationship, which does end, and I don't want to give it away for people who haven't read it,
mm-hmm.
so you know, it does end in a particularly interesting way at the end. For him, it solved a problem.
Mm-hmm.
That was, he couldn't figure out how to put his life back together after a tragedy that
mm-hmm.
happened in his own life. And I thought that was, you know, that was pretty powerful to me.
Well, there's a passage that comes to mind, though, about trying to square the circle of how he can fit all these pieces back together, what he's lost and what he hopes to get from this young woman, again, half his age, and his realization that he can't figure out the mathematical formula that makes it work. He can't put everybody in this future. And that's what the book is about, and that's the problem it's trying to solve.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that you had that particular problem yourself in a
no.
literal way.
No, certainly not.
But we all have, you know, we all have to wrestle with
yeah.
our, you know, growing up and what does it mean, and mm-hmm. we have children and, you know, who are we?
What can't we do anymore, and what do we have to really
yeah.
say, well, I don't remember the moment where I can't do that anymore, but I can't do it anymore.
Right. Although, again, there's this interesting thing. You know, I go to a lot of shows. I'm probably the oldest guy there almost every time.
Yep.
And you described, there was one scene that I thought was pretty powerful where, you know, they're talking about your guy who's like 40,
mm-hmm.
let's say. And the kids in the show are saying, this old guy, you know, this really old guy. You know, when you're 40, you don't think of yourself as that old. And in fact, you don't look that old to yourself.
Right.
You maybe never
they
do.
They were trying to gauge his age, too. And they were like, hey, he's probably 50-something, maybe
right.
60. I'm
yeah,
not sure.
Right. Kids, nobody knows. 20-year-olds.
Right.
There's that beauty of being self-involved. And, of course, it's there. The other part of it is it's always their scene.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you go into one of those clubs and it's their scene and you're kind of an outsider based on age,
mm-hmm.
they don't. Now, I found that nobody really gives you the fish eye. They're not saying, you know, get out of my space, you know, you old guy, you know, you look like my father or something.
Right.
They don't do that. But you do feel the difference.
Yeah. And I don't get the impression that they're thinking, oh, good, our music has appeal up into the next generation. It's much more like there's something very quirky and odd about that person coming into here. Why would he want to be here?
Right. Although I've taken my, you know, teenagers to clubs, I got lots of compliments from people who were working the show. They would say stuff, you know, they would be older people, they're working there, and they would say, you know, they'd notice that I was bringing my 15-year-old to see Rage Against the Machine or something, and they would kind of say, you know, you're really cool.
Right.
And that was so, but if you're going in as a 40-year-old and kind of hovering in the back, being a fan, it may be a little different.
It's a little bit like candy at the playground, sort of.
Yeah. And you know, what you didn't do, I thought, you didn't give the reader a clue that they had to go in a certain direction feeling about him. In other words, you didn't paint him as crazy. Obsessed, yes. Internally kind of complicated. But you didn't tell us this is a crazy guy.
Right.
You didn't put him in a place where we had to feel sorry for him or worry about him, although his brother worries about him and his... But I thought that was really well done because you don't want to feel told by the author this is how you're supposed to feel.
That's definitely something I aspire to. I don't want to write anything where it's clear who the heroes and the villains are and it's clear what and that you. I feel like you should. That's the fun of a novel. You should be able to say I wouldn't do that, or I would do that, or I might do that, or whatever the answer may be. There are people who find that I think very discomforting, and who sort of. Like some of the reviews that were negative of the book certainly said, well, this guy's not acting like a lover, he's acting like a stalker, as if that were a criticism of the, of the
right.
book.
Right, why is it a criticism of the book?
It frustrated them.
Right, but that's part of the bit, you know, I guess, you know, once you send your baby out into the world, you never know what's going to happen. It's sort of, I have thought about the fact that for authors, you have the same situation with fans sometimes that rock and roll stars do.
Oh boy, not
less, less. But there is the element of that relationship. The reader who feels that the novel has possessed them then gets a sense of ownership about the work and feels that, you know, they kind of have this special relationship with the author, which is not real. It's it's a projection,
right?
Which we do, which your author, you know, which your main character does.
It's funny, but what I see much more often is a feeling of betrayal. You know, if you read the one-star Amazon reviews of anybody's book, they're all pretty much the same review. You could really take the title out, and the same thing keeps coming up. And it's a very strong feeling of betrayal that they have been fooled into paying money for something which was intended to make them feel bad.
Rather than uplift them, in other words.
Exactly.
And that they're rejecting the idea that a novel could make you feel bad, make you think, challenge your emotions.
But that somehow they have been a conspiracy of critics, other readers, the author, the publishing house, has gotten them in a position where they've now been forced to imbibe something unpleasant, which was specifically made by somebody with the intention of making them feel bad and having a bad experience.
Right.
And that finally this crime has been committed and they're mad about it, understandably, and they want to express how bad they feel about it. And that sort of projection I have seen a lot of and might have been in the back of my mind a little bit during this process that there is this feeling that the work of art was created with you specifically in mind and was intended to push your buttons, which, having had them pushed, you're resentful of or pleased by or something.
I wonder where that comes from.
Well, I don't know, but I suppose that people have... I've had that experience. I mean, I've grown out of it, but I remember reading a book. What was the book? The Sleepwalkers by Hermann Broch, which I read because Milan Kundera, whom I loved, said, this is the best European novel ever written. And I read it, and I hated it, and I was mad at it, and I felt like... I remember selling it back to the used bookstore and kind of giving it the finger as it went over the counter, as if somehow Kundera and Hermann Broch and everybody was in on this thing to make me not have a good reading experience. I've since grown out of that. And books I don't like are not my fault and they're not the writer's fault. It's just bad chemistry.
Right.
But there is a youthful, certainly, feeling that art if you're open to art, as I certainly am, into any form, music or painting or theater or whatever, a feeling that you have to be, I think you have to be trained out of the idea that someone has failed you or succeeded for you.
And that, well, maybe it's a, you, it, I don't know whether it's unique to our culture, but there is, that kind of ties into a, an ongoing theme of kind of cultural criticism that Americans are self-centered. And that we're taught, maybe it's from school, I don't know, that the way literature is taught, in order to make it appealing, I think it's kind of reduced to personalize it. You know, it's made.
Can you identify?
Yeah. How do you identify with the? I mean, you see it with high school English. You know, how do you identify with the main character of this novel? Well, why should you?
Exactly. He's not your friend. He's not you. He's.
And what if the book was written in 1750? You're not going to identify. Well, maybe you do, but that's not why it was written.
Exactly. Exactly. And the corollary to the how do you identify with it is what is the writer trying to say? As if the writer had this thing they were trying to say, but unable to say it, inadvertently wrapped it up in characters and scenes. And
well, but that's the tyranny of criticism.
Yeah.
That all novels are treated as work to be taken apart and understood.
To get the fortune cookie out of the
middle
of it.
To understand the core meaning without then being able to, I mean, it takes you away from the ability to experience, direct experience, as I forget where that comes from, the direct apprehension of experience. That, how about just reading it and letting it affect you?
Right.
And not having to understand it or figure it out or I guess I would say reduce it because the description of it, and that's what I try, you know, I try not to do when I'm interviewing writers in these conversations, is to reduce the work into bite-sized pieces that people can understand. And that's why I thought kind of remarkably bad the, you know, the descriptions of the book. You know, they were like the Kirkus, you know, they're all talking about it, and they have to. I understand it's a reductivist effort. But I, you know, I really do think this book has a lot of resonance for just, you know, for maybe, I don't know whether I can say a generation because I think that's ridiculous, but for anybody who's involved in pop culture or American or modern culture of any kind, you have lots of things going on here that are really powerful. And I thought the, you know, the description of the way the you as a, or the main character as a, college kid was going to trying to invent the iPod. You know, you kind of set down why the iPod is so powerful as a device. And again, that's not to reduce the novel. That's I don't think the novel is about the iPod.
Right.
But it's a feature of the book, and it makes it really. You know, I walk around New York. I see people listening to music, and we sometimes kind of laugh at them. Being so involved in this place that you know that separates them from everybody else, but it's a good place.
Yeah,
sometimes
they're having a profound artistic experience right in front of you, and they don't care whether you're involved in it or not.
And that is, I think, you know, powerfully why the iPod has been so successful because it empowers people to take the music with them, and the music is really important.
Absolutely. If you could take every museum with you, if you could take the entire library, you know, with you, then people will start doing that.
We can do that with the iPhone.
Yes.
And that's, I think, to me, the iPhone is essentially the, you know, again, kind of this groundbreaking device because it really does enable you, I mean, again, reductivist because we're looking at art on this little tiny screen, but that's a pretty powerful thing. Music, you know, obviously, music travels.
Right.
It's pretty good. It's better than video. You know, maybe we can talk a little bit more in a second section. I want to ask you some questions about how music and writing compare, the way you think about those. Mm-hmm. So maybe we'll close this chapter and we'll start another section, if that's all right with you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you, Arthur Phillips, author of The Song Is You. And by the way, the website for Arthur is arthurphillips.info. Because there must be other Arthur Phillips out there who got there before you did.
Intruders, exactly.
They stole your name and they stole your domain. Thanks, Arthur, and thank you for Writer's Cast.